This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 26th of October 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to edition 277 of the Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bounds, and Tom Edwards.
Coming up on today's programme, we hear from the editor of the weird and wonderful Weekly World News.
Also, zoologist Jules Howard brings a whole new meaning to the first time as he guides us through the story of sex on Earth.
Plus, we enter the world where art and science meet and look ahead to the coming week's news agenda with Monocle's Thomas Lewis.
That's all coming up right here on the Monocle Weekly. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Rob. How are you this Sunday lunchtime?
Very good. You sounded like that as if it wasn't Sunday lunchtime.
I know.
So you're sort of projecting forward.
I get a bit wistful on the weekends sometimes.
I know, I know. It's nice to be here. It's nice to be in the chilled environs of Studio One. I like to be here. What I like to be doing at about midday at London time on a Sunday afternoon is to be in a well-air-conditioned studio with a member of another co-worker.
Yes, yeah, a couple of colleagues.
Yes.
Yeah, I like to leave my friends and family far behind.
Goodbye.
Because we're all friends and a family of sorts here.
It's a broad church, isn't it?
It is. It's wonderful. Interesting community.
Well, and how's your week been? Has your nose been fugged up against the glass of radio?
Yeah,
It's been busy. Like an eager child.
It's been busy. I felt I've sort of built steadily to a crescendo, which was on Friday afternoon.
We're not on the sex on Earth thing, are we?
No, that's coming up later.
Okay, good.
All sorts of interesting sexual crescendos are going to be reached in this programme, Rob.
Yeah, you've been doing a bit of research for one of our upcoming guests, which is Jules Howard, talking about sex on Earth, which is a book about how and why animals have sex. And I think you've been not interested in the practical side of it so much, but it's a well-dog-eared volume. Normally, we sometimes have to skim people's books, don't we? It's the pressure of time.
Well, you just need to know. It's things you never considered about flamingos, hedgehogs, all sorts of
others. Bonobo monkeys.
I imagine we'll be touching on bonobos later, as it were.
Praying mantis is the only animal I know that's got a strange diet.
We should bring that up with Jules a little later
and
see what he has to say about it. I bet he's got an anecdote or two.
I think it sounds like time, as we're talking about the weird, the wonderful and the slightly deranged, it's time to bring out the best man from Wales, Thomas Lewis.
Baby. Who knew the news could be so hot? Delivering a look ahead to the week's events, here's Tom Edwards.
Thomas Lewis, we should say, welcome to the programme.
Thank you
Using
very much.
Someone else's theme tune, how do you think that's going to go down with Tom Edwards? Oh, he's right here.
Where did you get that theme tune
he's
from?
He's fuming. I can see the steam coming out of his ears right now.
Absolutely apoplectic about that.
Yeah.
I think a slave over those idents.
Excuse me. Just clear my throat before we get started.
Make yourself at home. What's going to happen next week, Tom?
There is a lot happening next week, Rob.
Okay.
Busy week ahead for you and Tom Edwards.
Have you got my diary in front of you?
Quite intriguing reading, Rob. So on Monday, October the 27th, tomorrow, of course, the big, well, probably one of the most anticipated mayoral elections anywhere ever, possibly. The voters of Toronto go to the polls. Some of them are going already. Early voting has been expanded this year to try and make the whole process a bit easier. And turnout's been quite high so far, it seems. Of course, it's been an extraordinary journey to voting day. The incumbent, Rob Ford, of course, very late in the day, withdrew after those revelations that he was suffering pretty severely from cancer. Then his brother, Doug, then putting his name into the ring with an hour to go before the registration closed. And Olivia Chow, it was her race to lose, so they said back in the day, is now still trailing behind both John Tory, who's the Conservative candidate, and then Doug Ford. And
I think all people from a certain party should be named after their party. So John Tory is the Conservative candidate. I think it should be like that.
Mickey Labour.
He's very good policies. Very
Barbara nice. Lib Dems, I don't
Barbara
know.
Barbara Lib Dems, exactly.
Yeah. So anyway, so it should be an interesting race. I was in Toronto a couple of weeks ago and speaking to people about some of the issues at play, and it really has sort of churned up a lot of emotions. Obviously, you know, Rob Ford's time at City Hall in Toronto, highly controversial to some, highly popular to others. So it's really been a pretty sort of distinct period, I think, in Toronto politics, and people are quite intrigued to see what happens next.
Do you think even people who maybe were not fans of Rob Ford, which I imagine include most right-minded people, they're going to be a bit sad, aren't they? Because that was an era of non-stop political entertainment.
But
political
entertainment, yes. But then, you know, Toronto is a great city, and I think there is a sense that, of course, you want politics to be exciting, intriguing, have a bit of a laugh now and then. But if that means your city becomes a bit of a laughing stock, that actually that distracts from some of the great things that are happening in a city like Toronto, then I think, you know, quite rightly, people are looking for a change. Now, if Doug Ford does triumph on Monday, then I think there will be a lot of people who might sort of, you know, roll their eyes slightly and be like, well, is this more of the same? I think, you know, it's quite interesting that the more conservative candidates have been doing quite well in Toronto. I think that's obviously how Rob Ford got elected in the first place. But I think, you know, from some of the people I was speaking to, there was a sense that actually, you know, Toronto is such a lively, vibrant, sort of open, liberal city that actually that they'd quite like that to be reflected in City Hall as well.
This programme is brought to you by Toronto, a vibrant and open city. What is happening in another city not as good as Toronto next?
Well, number two in the list of good cities, yeah, let's say, is New York City. Okay. Controversial statement.
I was going to say, a lot of people would disagree with you, that me being one of them. Let's go for it. Let's see why it's not as good as Toronto.
The switchboards at Monocle 24 are lighting up as we speak. So on Monday, the 27th of October, yep, the New York City subway celebrates a fairly special anniversary. It's 100 years since the first line opened in the subway there, 1904. It cost, so my notes show me, $40 million at the time. And
1904, did you say?
1904, yeah.
I make that 110 years.
110 years old.
110 years old, yeah.
There's no flies on me, Thomas Lewis.
Well, you remember it quite well. You were around back then, weren't you?
I was still in short trousers.
Bants.
Bants, indeed, there we are. That's great. So 110 years.
Short pants. Yes.
Short pants and long socks. So 110 years since the New York subway first opened. And yes, it's now the New York City subway station. This surprised me slightly, this little fact, that it's the seventh busiest transit system in the world. I would have thought that actually
it would
be higher up the list.
What was the first line? Is it the A train, the B train, the C line?
The B, I believe.
Oh, God. I don't even out of all those, I got it wrong. Okay, fine.
But what, frankly, don't quote me.
Why did I do that?
Don't know. Really, that's a conversation for another day, Tom, I think. Okay. Shall we go to more serious matters?
Yes.
Okay, so on November the 1st and the 2nd in Abbeville, Louisiana, it's a great event taking place. It is the Giant Omelette Celebration, which has been happening since the 1980s, since 1985, in fact. And it's a huge affair. So the story goes, the history of this little event.
Where is Abbeville?
Abbeville is in Louisiana, okay, in the United States. Mm-hmm. Never been. I'm sure it's very, very nice. Good omelettes, they tell me.
No subway, though. No, subway. I didn't go on anyway.
That's number 432nd on the busiest transit systems in the world. Anyway, yeah. So legend has it that Napoleon once enjoyed an omelette so much that he ordered a huge omelette to be made for his army from all the eggs in the village he happened to be at the time. So okay. Abbeville in 1985 wanted to reclaim some of its French heritage and celebrate all things omelette-y. And this has been going since then. You're good with maths, Tom. You can tell us what anniversary.
I was going to say, according to your watch, that would be almost 20 years ago.
Nice, okay.
And but it's a good fun thing. 5,000 eggs.
So they, do they make a huge one like in the town centre, like they do, yeah, with these it's like huge paellas?
What flavour's the omelette?
What flavours the omelette?
What's it got in it?
Well, I think they're purists down in Abbeville. I think
just
it's
a
bit of cheese.
Just
a bit of butter.
Omelette.
Yeah.
Egg white
cream,
omelette.
Probably.
Well, if you're a real purist.
Really?
I'm not a fan of egg whites.
No. Well, I like them. They're best in a meringue, aren't they? I wouldn't just have an omelette.
Yes, absolutely. No, I'd agree with you there, yeah.
You need some yellow in there.
You do need some yellow in there, yeah. Yeah. Shall we have one more before I get checked out?
I don't think we should end on that
car crash of a newsroom.
Let's end up with some pudding.
Oh, great. This is something I'm looking forward to very much. On November the 2nd...
Is it a fag?
Yeah, there is. Okay. That. Yes, a nice big strong cup of coffee. Nick Wallenda, what does that name mean to you?
Is he a tennis player from the 80s?
No, he's not.
Oh, that's
no.
Mats Wallander.
The detective?
No, he's not a detective, no. It's a fun game, though.
Let's put us out of our miseries.
Okay, so he is a tightrope walker. So he, if you remember last year, traversed the Grand Canyon. Great international.
Yeah.
It was an amazing sight, actually. Absolutely extraordinary. And he's, of course, from this family of tightrope walkers who have this really long, really entertaining history of doing these crazy feats. So Chicago is the setting for the next challenge.
What's he going to do, Tom?
So he is going to walk. This is quite complicated in my small mind anyway. So he's going to walk from one of the Marina Towers buildings to the other. in downtown Chicago, which is, I think, about two city blocks. And I think he's going to do that blindfolded and untethered. Which
seems
like the
news
pretty
look ahead. Blindfolded and untethered. That would be a feat. That's something. And what? Oh God, I want to watch it. Is this on the TV?
It's on the TV. Yes, exactly.
Okay,
yeah, yeah. It'll be live, beamed live around the world. I imagine, like the Grand Canyon stunt was last year. But I mean,
I'm worried for
him.
When is this happening?
That's happening next weekend. Would you believe in Chicago?
I can't wait to watch that. Chicago is one of my favourite cities. I've never looked at it from that vantage point.
Okay. All right. Tom Lewis, thank you very much indeed for popping in and giving us your news look ahead.
You're very welcome. A little freewheeling, so forgive me for that.
No, I loved it.
Thank you, as
I like
ever,
it.
For having me. Do appreciate it.
Founded in 1979, the Weekly World News has given its readers surreal urban legends, satirical stories and even alien president predictors for years. A one-time staple for many an American student and relief-seeking reader, the publication ceased its print edition in 2007, but it lives on online.
And a new book, paying tribute to the most admirable enterprise, is out now and edited by the Weekly World News editor-in-chief, Neil McGuinness. Neil joined us on the line from New York to tell us more.
I mean, we have our grabbers from time to time in terms of headlines, and, you know, that's been, I think, a strong suit. Our writers, you know, I mean, obviously the UK has got the best writers around, you know, but look, we tried to do our best. We had some Fleet Street refugees come over in the early days and sort of live out their last days in the Florida Sun, which is where the publication was put together until I moved it to New York.
Tell me, Neil, is there a sort of a typical, or was there ever a typical Weekly World News journalist then? Because that intrigues me, that this idea of people sort of travelling from all around the world, because the brand of stories, the unique style is immediately identifiable. Are the journalists the same, or do they come from, is it quite a broad church?
You know, I tend to notice a lot of similar traits in our journalists. Mostly they tend to be very shiftless, so I, you know, spend a lot of my day listening to various excuses that they come up with for why they're not writing. Our West Coast bureau chief hasn't, I don't think he's filed a story in like 3 years, so it's been quite a job managing these folks. But when they do manage to pull it together, sometimes the results are pretty amazing.
And maybe you can tell us, actually, Neil, because this show goes out all over the world. It'd be nice to fill. People clearly can use the Google part of their computer to find out what it's all about. But can you fill us in? Give us a little bit of the history of what it is and the vibe, really, for our international listeners who might not have been able to pick it up from their supermarket shelves.
Sure. Weekly World News was born as an offshoot of the National Enquirer here in the United States, which became a phenomenally successful. And it was sort of the redheaded stepchild for the Enquirer, in the sense that if the Enquirer was running a story about a politician having an affair, we would take the opportunity that same week to run a story about a politician having an affair with an alien. And so we were able to kind of cultivate all the important details of, you know, various topical events without having to, really bury people, which is something that the National Enquirer became known for after a time. But, as far as its impact on American culture and its importance, I think, in our overall cultural history, it's really the first instance of news of suspect credibility coming out into the mass market. And so in that same tradition, it owes a lot of influence to things like Saturday Night Live, but also inspired things like The Onion, numerous movies, musicals, television shows, and Men in Black. If you're familiar with that film franchise, there's a great scene in which Tommy Lee Jones, as Agent K, turns to Will Smith and picks up Weekly World News on the newsstand and says, "You know, this is the only way to find out what's really going on in the universe, and you know, this is the key to where the aliens are."
Neil, tell us, how's it changed then since it sort of went from print to online? Because obviously there's a book out now, which is a sort of celebration of some of the finest headlines, and fine, they surely are. Did it change the dynamic, do you think, when it stops being the kind of thing you'd pick up in print, like you said, when you're queuing at the supermarket, and goes online? Or in a way, does that make it kind of give it even more power? There's even more possibilities?
You know, the certainly the influence of the brand itself grew when we focus more online. And we've had, I don't know, maybe over 100 million people have come to our website since we launched it in 2009. And I think, you know, if anything, the editorial cycle just became a lot more up to the minute, whereas we would have certain kind of benchmarks editorially for the year. You know, we'd have, you know, our monster edition around Halloween. I mean, now we have to focus on monsters and sea monsters in particular almost 24/7.
And I guess the secret of the success or the way that it links with what you might call the regular media, the straight media, Neil, is how similar the stories are to the stories that run maybe in well-known British tabloids, and you mentioned the National Enquirer. It's kind of how close it is to the bone of reality that makes it such a witty and well-written thing, right?
Absolutely, because, you know, that line between the real and unreal, I mean, the line between sense and nonsense, the line between belief and disbelief is razor thin. And so we really exist just to make that line even thinner.
I want to read a couple of things to Tom here. Clinton hires 3-breasted intern. Shocked Hillary says, I thought he was a leg man. It's that with egomaniac lawyer marries himself. I think I've seen that on the steps of Islington, Islington Town Hall here in London. This is the kind of stuff that would be very familiar to lots of our British listeners as well. The fact that these are the sorts of things that, you know, might get hidden away, crazily hidden away on the inside of a newspaper. You're presumably shining a light on the corridors of power, but completely accidentally, Neil. It's something that Amanda Iannucci was asked after writing The Thick of It, whether there was, you know, the UK government, someone had a fly on the wall there. These things, presumably, a lot of editorial product in America must be scared that you're stealing stories from them, right?
Exactly. I mean, that was, you know, the Enquirer and the Weekly World News shared a lot of reporting sources from time to time. And so, you know, stories like the 3-breasted intern, John Edwards affair, the Gary Hart affair on the monkey business, I mean, all those things were kind of kicked around the collective office water cooler. So that, yeah, there was definitely a lot of trading on information. And if anything, though, Washington tended to embrace us a little bit tighter than the National Enquirer, because we were never mean spirited, although we did, you know, I think shock the world from time to time. But, you know, even things like the 3-breasted intern that Clinton hired, you know, there is actually now just a week and a half ago, there was a story about another a woman who's actually fired from her job for having 3 breasts here in the United States.
It proves you really couldn't make it up. I just wanted to ask you, Neil, because we talked sort of about the joshing, especially sort of lampooning people on Capitol Hill. But sometimes the editorial sort of voice was pretty spot on. I'm thinking back, of course, to your celebrated alien political analyst, who was always right on the money when it came to calling the shots in presidential elections.
Yeah, that's right. You know, Pilad, who's our political prognosticator, who happens to be an alien, he's called every political race for president here in the United States spot on since 1980. So it's been remarkable, his string. Now, of course, here in the States, you have the incumbent as quite an advantage. So generally, if you have a one-term president, it's pretty easy to call that second term. I mean, the one that he had to do was the hard one, was really George Bush, you know, who was not able to get a second term, George Bush Sr. and Clinton, when Clinton swept in. So that was really the alien's big call. And from there, he just kept riding.
Is there anything, what sort of stuff doesn't make it in? Is it stuff that's too wild, or is it stuff that's not wild enough? What tends to stay on the sort of cutting room floor now?
It tends to be subjective. I mean, I have an unnatural fear of rabbits, so I tend to not want to do anything about rabbits. And so anything, as I said, mean-spirited, you know, I don't, you know, if people have alcohol problems, you know, that's not something we generally want to trumpet from our pulpit, but you know, other than that, I mean, you know, alcohol abuse and rabbits tend to be the only things that we're kind of shying away from.
Neil, tell me, they always say, you know, especially to sort of journalists, so you should never meet your heroes because you're always disappointed. You mentioned how you were a sort of fan of this brand before. What was it like then when you actually sort of came through the door, even if it was only a metaphorical door, and sort of took control? Did it live up to your hopes, or can you enjoy it even the same way that you used to in your young, carefree days?
It really did, in the sense that, you know, it was a cult of true believers that I encountered, and the mission became shared. And when we brought it online, I think that the spirit kind of rode true as ever. So it was a lot of fun. But, you know, economic part of it, obviously, a little bit different. We had this wonderful financial collapse here in the United States in 2008, which coincided, I think, with the period in which I took over the brand. So that made things somewhat interesting. I mean, you find yourself at one point more solvent than General Motors, and that is not a good portent for the economy here in the United States when Weekly World News has, is fiscally more sound than the biggest company in the country.
You'd kind of expect that to be one of your headlines.
Right.
As you say, most of the stories are a clever, they're a satirical lampooning of the kind of current state of the US and of the world. Occasionally, obviously, there are celebrity stories, celebrity front pages in it. Has anyone ever, it's boring to hear if they've complained, I wonder if anyone's been extremely flattered to be accused of having three breasts or have married an alien or to have morphed into a toad overnight when they were asleep?
That's an excellent question. We have actually had a lot of accolades from different celebrities that were just honored, really, to be picked up in our coverage. In fact, the last one that comes to mind was Kim Kardashian. We had done a story that on a transcontinental flight here in the United States, one of her rear-end implants had ruptured somewhere over Las Vegas and caused the plane to have to make an emergency diversionary landing into Vegas. And obviously, everybody was wondering what was going on, and they weren't told the truth, and ultimately the plane made it to Los Angeles, and everything was fine. But when the Kardashian entourage was informed of this story, they were overjoyed and actually wanted to feature it on their television show.
I can see a 911 reconstruction already taking its shape on some major network there, Neil.
So many, Neil, to choose from, and it's, you know, that most recent story there that you cite, one example. Do you have favourites, or is it like a parent who can never choose their favourite offspring? Do you have a favourite story?
He's already called it a red-headed stepchild. Come on.
But what about a favourite? There must be a favourite headline out of all of the wealth to choose from. Is there one that is sort of seared into your mind more than any other?
Well, in the book, there's one, a dolphin named Ginzo, who was born with human arms and, you know, had managed to escape from a Japanese research tank. Of course, the Japanese are very interested in finding out everything they can about dolphins and other ocean mammals. But Ginzo was somewhat horny and loved female companionship. You know, one of the things that was happening while he was in his tank in captivity in Japan is they were trying to decipher the dolphin language, which predates our own verbal language by, you know, thousands of years. And unfortunately, as they were in the process of trying to unlock the keys to the way dolphins communicate, there was a drain malfunction in his holding pool, and it sucked him to the bottom, and one of his arms tragically was lost. At that point, they were no longer able to really pick up anything from the hand signal language that he was demonstrating for them. And so it was kind of a sad tale, Ginzo the dolphin, but it had happy moments at time when he bonded with his female trainer erogenously.
Yeah, well, you know, there's light and shade, isn't there, in the Weekly World News? And I think that probably story sums up the pathos. Not the bathos, the pathos of it. Neil McGuinness, thank you so much for joining us and talking us through the Weekly World News, and happy anniversary.
The Entrepreneurs is Monocle's weekly audio guide to the world's best business minds. From industry giants and family outfits to the one-man bands and clever upstarts.
We saw all this immense amount of frustration by young people finding their first jobs, their second jobs, internships. And we said it's ridiculous that in this day and age, with all the technology we have, we can't solve that.
Tune in at 1900 hours London time every Wednesday to hear insider tips, big challenges, and sparks of insight. We take an hour-long tour of the worlds of fashion to food, timepieces to tech, and hear the founding stories of some of the smartest names around.
I remember saying, deliver beer in New York City. I can hardly afford my car insurance, so I'm going to insure a truck.
That's The Entrepreneurs, every Wednesday at 1900 hours London time, right here on Monocle 24.
You're listening to The Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, and Robert Bound. In a few minutes, we'll be hearing about a book illuminating the inhabitants of the animal kingdom and their sex lives. So here to prepare us is Devon Sprawl with Unmarked Animals.
That was Devon Sprawl with Unmarked Animals.
The sexual revolution didn't happen, as you might think, in the 1960s. No, it happened 1,000 million years ago. That's according to a new book by zoologist Jules Howard, who takes us back to the moment that sex happened for the very first time.
In Sex on Earth, Jules explores the how and why of earthly sex and animal reproduction, and he joins us now in the studio, fresh from a steak luncheon, we should say.
Delicious. Thank you very much, guys. Thank you.
Thanks for coming on the programme, Jules. First of all, are the best animals the ones that enjoy the most sex, or the best sort of quality of sex? Is it all about the sort of Darwinism of doing it right?
I spent quite a long time, genuinely, months and months and months, pondering that very question. How much enjoyment do animals get out of having sex? Are they like sort of some animals, are they just sort of sex robots and they're just doing actions that, you know, lead to eggs and, you know, that's all you need?
Yeah.
Or whether some animals are really getting something out of it.
Loving it.
And possibly loving themselves in various ways as well. So they clearly are the ones that are enjoying it, much like, you know, our little branch of the life's family tree. There's an animal called, have you ever heard of bonobos?
Yeah,
Of course. Yeah, but they are.
But they're connoisseurs, I gather.
They are.
Is this right?
Yeah. I think they give us a run for our money. Honestly, their range of sort of sexual behaviours are kind of staggering, really. And they even use it, apparently, they even use it as a bartering tool. So females will say, yeah, I really want that banana. Come on then, let's go. I'll have that banana. So, you know, there's a little bit of that going on. And then more, you know, I think it's changed me forever. But the more you look into animals as a whole, the more you realise every single animal's kind of weird for some sort of different reason, I guess.
Bring a little bit of Braintree into the animal kingdom.
I love the quote. That'll be the paperback quote.
Yeah, that could be the one. I wanted to ask you a bit more about that, because presumably at the outset of studying this in a lot more detail and writing about it, you must have some fairly good ideas about some particularly strong kind of story lines, narrative arcs, if you will, that are going to make particularly compelling reading. Were you kind of staggered? I sense maybe with bonobos, were there times when you were kind of shocked by what you discovered about the proclivities of some of our friends in the animal kingdom?
It's the first book I've ever written. And the first draft of it was just total trivia overload. It's like wood lice have a strange little patch, and the males hold onto the females there and have strange little forks. Frogs have funny little gloves that they grab onto the female with them. All this sort of thing. And it was literally, you said a narrative arc. It was impossible to get a narrative arc with so many facts. So I had to actually just bin off loads of the characters to get that strong sense of really explaining why these weird behaviours have evolved, the interesting side, and the kind of, a little bit, you know, the scientists who choose to study these sort of, what are to us, quite weird things, I guess. But yeah, I'm still a bit sad about some of the things that had to go.
And presumably, some of your books sort of maps out why animals look the way they do. A lot of we're familiar with, you know, the sort of the bright plumage on certain birds and this and that, and, you know, appendages. But bonobos, the monkeys with the big noses that look like willies.
Oh, proboscis monkeys. Yeah, those are. Ones. But they certainly have willies that look like willies.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. A few. But there's a lot of the courtship ritual is about sort of the showiness. But then presumably there must be the more dour, dull looking animals. It must be at it like knives.
Yeah, I got quite into deep sea fish for a while, because obviously where there is no light, animals can't evolve.
There's showiness. No shame either. Yeah.
Well, apparently not. But, you know, at the bottom of the sea, you know, having a peacock's tail is useless.
Yeah.
So animals evolve, you know, different sort of pheromones, different sorts of smells. And I guess we are used to having the senses that we do. We see sex in a kind of like, oh, showy. Oh, that smells nice. Nice singing. But actually most animals on Earth are kind of like, oh, yeah, nice smell. They're really going for like the smell. I'm not sure they speak with that accent, but they're really going for that kind of smell.
A bit like sort of, you know, yeah, I like that. Sort of like rather louche. But like sort of like Leslie Phillips. Ooh, Leslie Phillips, you know, the sort of hatchet fish is the Leslie Phillips.
But I wonder actually, Jules, is that a problem? Is there a tendency or a temptation perhaps for other observers, analysts, and maybe, I don't know if you felt that this was a trap you had to constantly avoid, to sort of project our own human experience of sex and our expectations of it, even our language of it, exactly kind of as we've just done, onto the animal kingdom? Is that unhelpful in some way? Or actually, does it sort of help to explain some of the peculiarities?
One of the reasons I wrote the book actually was because of all things pandas. For that exact reason, really, we are really quick as a species, really quick to label an animal like, that one's got an enormous appendage, that one's very small and it's rubbish at the act of love. And pandas are a classic one where literally at the moment this time of year when, you know, the newscasts say, unfortunately, there's no more baby pandas in Edinburgh. They're not going to be born this year. It's been a failure again. Lots and lots of discussion about pandas are rubbish. Why are we forking out all this money on conserving pandas and all this sort of stuff? And very quick to sort of judge them as sexual failures, when actually in the wild, these animals are as sexually prolific as any other animal. And people always say, pandas, you know, they're only ovulating for like 2 days every year. They are absolute rejects. But the reason they've evolved to sort of have such tiny reproductive windows is because they are absolutely brilliant at getting it in the wild. You know, that's a sign of complete efficiency, if you like, for these animals. But yeah, we're so
do they suffer from performance anxiety then? Is that what happens?
Well, yeah.
They can hear the sort of newscaster.
Maybe they can't hear the newscasters, but they certainly apparently quite, you know, a little bit, if there's planes flying overhead, they're a little bit like, why is that massive, strange, noisy eagle flying overhead, yeah, perhaps? Why haven't I got a bamboo forest out there? You know, there could be a bit of that. And for years, you know, the reason for pandas kind of failing was because we didn't give the pandas an opportunity to smell each other's urine. Urine is quite important to a panda.
I could have told them that.
Where were you 50 years ago in London Zoo?
I know. I was around the praying mantis.
Oh, were you?
Cage, I love those things. I love those guys.
So praying mantises, you know about them, right?
No. Tell them. Oh, yes. So is this, I think I do. I think from some dark recess of my brain. This is where the female eats the male after sex.
Yes. Well, for years, this was like popular.
Not in a good way, Tom. Culture. Not in the way you're... Sorry, not in the colloquial way, I mean, eating them.
Another mind meander there, just for a moment.
I thought I was the one who had to be careful about what we were talking about. Okay, that's fine. No, for years, people thought they were definitely one of the animals that each time the male would allow his head to be bitten off midway through the act. Yeah. But some species, most species, don't go for that. But there is a species, a European species, that does just that. The male, to make sure the female doesn't lose interest and try and find another mate, he basically goes, here, just eat my head. And he carries on. Actually, without a head, he'll carry on thrusting.
Really?
Yes.
What is the kinkiest animal?
That sounds pretty kinky to me, the mantis. No?
The mantis.
That's pretty kinky.
Headless thrusting.
I quite like, yeah. I'm not sure if it's the kinkiest, but a lot of spiders, they males have these things called palps. They're like, they look like funny little boxing gloves or antlers, and they basically are big pumps and they can squirt in sperm. But to actually manage to get these palps into the female's holes, she has two kinds of holes, he has to sort of run right up to her face and sort of dodge her jaws and then just plug them in and then basically quickly pump them and then quickly sort of jet off again.
Very
because
strange.
Obviously females are much larger and they're going to get a little bit hungry midway through the act. So I quite like that, like running the gauntlet.
Jules, I wonder, you know, we're sort of having a few laughs about some of the sort of particular peculiarities and the more sort of esoteric techniques that our friends in the animal kingdom deploy. I mean, is there a more serious message? It's interesting, even talking about pandas, there's a lot of misunderstanding, I guess, from the humankind about how these other creatures reproduce and the way we need to respect their habitats, for example, so they can continue to, live healthily and happily in the world. Are you also keen to kind of press that point home, that it's about increasing our understanding of animals in all sorts of shapes and forms?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things that kind of gutted me as I was going into each area of animal sex and the evolution of animal sex was how little scientists seem to have been investing in things like homosexual behaviours, for instance, or things like that. These are areas that haven't really been massively studied, because partly to study them, these are kind of can be quite rare behaviours in animals. So to get like a nice notepad filled with observations, you'd have to be doing it in the field, so to speak, for 40 years or so. Mm. You know, you need a long commitment from scientists to study stuff like that. So what is it? There's hardly any information. So you said about a sexual revolution at the start, and the whole of sex on Earth, if you like, the evolution of it is a total revolution in the way animals behave and the forms in which they come. But in the last... I don't know, 20 years, there's a kind of sexual revolution in the way that we study animals as well. So my hope from the book and my hope from other scientists involved in this sort of work is that we start aiming away from the, why is the penis looking like that? And we start sort of thinking, let's have a look at these weirder stuff like autoerotism, you know, looking at homosexuality and homosexual behaviours, I should say. Loads of science, loads of news stories about the strange shapes and sizes of animal penises. Not enough science going into vaginas, because for every weird penis, this is the one big thing I learned, I think, for every weird penis, there is going to be a weird vagina.
Well, that's good for the two respective creatures in that example.
Well, yeah,
because normally equality rules.
Normally an animal will get a really awesome penis if it's trying to guarantee that every act of sex is going to lead to more offspring. But the female doesn't want that. She doesn't want to get inseminated by anyone because no. she's got a bit of choice in the matter. So she might evolve a vagina that can basically say, not really that into you. I'm not going to allow you to fertilise my eggs. Off you go. And then she might loosen up a bit when she's finally got someone who she quite likes. Do you know what the animal I'm actually talking about is ducks, mallards. Okay. So next time you're feeding ducks, have a little look at how yellow the beak of the duck is. And if it's very yellow, that beak doesn't have many STDs.
Oh, right. If it's very yellow.
Yeah, okay, so nice and healthy, no STDs. You end up with a really nice,
so if it's all like mottled and white and
it's a
faded.
Bag.
It's an adult.
Dirty duck.
Let me just ask you, Jules, about that, because you talked about the sort of homosexual behaviours perhaps in some animals. And a lot of people say, well, this is very interesting because, you know, it's counter-evolutionary for creatures to, for example, try and, you know, raise offspring when they're not physically capable of so doing. And there's some interesting examples in the book. I mean, there's been a lot of high-profile examples in zoos. A lot of penguins, it seems to be, and I know you write about that in the book, often seem to exhibit these behaviours. Do we know any more about why that happens or how it happens or what the sort of evolutionary processes are that are at play there?
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of different theories, a whole bunch of different arguments. Not enough scientists debating those arguments at the moment. But one theory is that, you know, maybe these animals, this is something that is exposed in captive situations. So something about living in a tank, maybe it's a little bit like, for some animals, it might be a bit strange and maybe, you know, they are exhibiting natural behaviours in the wild in strange and unique ways in captivity. But having said that, in the book I go and visit Carlos and Fernando, which are Britain's only, I think, known homosexual flamingo couple. Although they're not anymore.
So good. Last year, I bet they're going to name a hotel after them in Miami.
But, you know, the jury's out as to how often their sort of relationships go on in the wild, because you can't sex a flamingo from a distance. You just can't do it. You have to get really close. So those people who study flamingos in the wild, they're not really able to say, yeah, those ones are homosexual, that one's a quad, because apparently sometimes like three boys and a female will raise chicks together and all sorts of weird sort of situations like that. But I think in birds especially, it might end up being really common.
And just finally, we're three blokes of a certain age sitting around in a radio studio. It's obviously a serious scientific topic, Jules, and I'm sure your book's brilliant, but we are all sort of tittering about it because we're sort of ashamed to be talking about it, so we kind of mask it with humour, don't we? Is this the same in the animal kingdom? Are animals sort of squeamish and sort of comedic and funny about sex, or is it quite a straightforward do you know what I mean?
There was a hand action there.
I did a sort of bearish hand action. But do you know what I mean? I wonder if animals skirt around the subject and use sort of decoying techniques and indeed the technique of coyness to mask their true sort of feelings on sex.
Yes. There is, I think it's a cuttlefish that will pretend it's a female so that it can get nice and close to other females, and then she will relax and sort of go, okay, this is not going to attack me and try and have sex with me. And then suddenly they fling into the male mode and attack. Well, not attack, they sexually go for it, basically. So there's a little bit of decoy stuff. Are we the only animals to sort of get a bit weird about it? I guess no one knows. It's hard to say. But for me, I always think, look, you know, if we're adding a bit of comedy to this, hopefully, I like to think that's a sign of advanced civilization. I like to think. So maybe we are the only ones. But who knows? In 20 years' time, we could be saying, I can't believe bonobos are funnier than us.
That was Jules Howard, author of Sex on Earth, A Celebration of Animal Reproduction. And that book is out now, published by Bloomsbury.
Up next on this show, Rob, we're going to be taking a look at a new world where art and science meet.
Monaco has shops around the world selling our exclusive collaborations with some of our favourite designers, including Ettinger, Porter, Barenna, Jawbone, Oliver Peoples, and many more. You can find us on College Street in Toronto, Hudson and Charles in New York, and in the heart of Wan Chai in Hong Kong, and two in London. So, whether you're after a versatile travelling wardrobe, something for the home, or a present for a loved one, or just missing back issues from your collection, you're sure to find something at the Monaco shop.
Now, science and gallery may not be two words you'd ordinarily put together, but opposite the Shard, here in London, a new space is being constructed to change all of that. Science Gallery will be a place where art and science meet. It's due to open in 2016 and is aimed at 15 to 25-year-olds, but in the run-up to that, a series of experimental seasons is underway to whet the public appetite.
Well, the director of Science Gallery is Dr. Daniel Glazer, a neuroscientist devoted to promoting public engagement with science. He joins us now in the studio. Welcome to the programme, Dan.
Hello.
And first of all, Science Gallery, as we said in the preface, two words that haven't tended to have sat happily next to each other before. Is this what you're going for, to make it not a museum? Is there a different agenda in your head?
Yes, there isn't. It's radio, so pictures are hard, but the logo has got a circle and a square next to each other, and we talk about where science and art collide. So when you say science, you think museum, and when you say gallery, you think art. And so we're definitely trying to destabilise the normal relationships between those two areas.
And it sounds also like, I mean, as we said, there's some pop-up things, there's things happening. The idea is that it also doesn't have a permanent collection, right? The idea that it is something that is a travelling circus that can kind of be all things to all people, presumably, is part and parcel of your remit.
That's exactly right. Yeah, so we have no permanent collection. When the building opens in 2016, we'll have seasons that will run for about 3 months. And interestingly, those seasons will be developed in the year or so before by engaging with the audience in advance. So, for example, the opening seasons like to be called addictive, and in the 6 months or so before it opens, we'll talk to addicts and pushers and local young people and musicians and receptor physiologists who study the brain and see what they have to think about the subject before we curate the show ourselves.
It does sound, particularly with this emphasis on engaging with younger people, I know that's something that's very important. Does that then reflect a general, I don't know what we'd call it, a frustration that you feel about how other institutions do talk to younger people? Is it too preachy? Is it too sort of didactic? Where's the problem come? Is it specific to science, or is it a bit of a general malaise, do you think?
I'm delighted with the way that other institutions deal with audiences, because it leaves a gap for me. The gap is there because the 15 to 25 year old audience are not well served for culture or science, in my view. So if you're 15 and you look at the younger generation, flashing lights, ball ponds, pressy buttons, funny hats, it's a complete turn off and they run a mile. But equally, you know, up to the age of 25, you're not necessarily going to want to have a panel discussion of an evening with a glass of wine and three experts and a gentle walk around an exhibition. So falling between those two modes of cultural engagement, the 15 to 25 year olds are underserved by conventional cultural offers.
We've been talking about the space that the gallery will operate within, sort of metaphorically. What about physically? It's by the Shard. What was that process like? Was it fun? Often people with a strong kind of curatorial or creative vision find it very difficult to locate a space that can kind of speak to their broader concerns and their agenda. Was that a challenge for you, or did it actually all happen relatively easily?
It was an opportunity. Europe's first McDonald's on a healthcare campus opened in 1992 on the Guy's campus, when the Shard was not even a twinkle in Renzo Piano's eye. And it had a 20-year lease from King's College, which owns the space. And when the lease was up, it was realised that this extraordinary location, and folks, those of you who haven't been down there, do come when you're next in town. It's an extraordinary crossroads which has been completely re-engineered over the last couple of years. This prime location opposite the Shard presented a huge opportunity for King's College to engage with people who wouldn't necessarily come by choice to a science art gallery, but would just be walking past and would see through the windows the extraordinary content, the experiments taking place, the visual arts, the young people engaging, and be drawn in simply in virtue of passing the door.
And can we talk about some of the concrete stuff about what Science Gallery will do? Is it take maybe this first addictive season? Because is neither science, it's neither science nor a gallery. Or, you know, so what is going to happen? What's the sort of meat and drink, Dan?
Before the building opens, we're running a couple of experimental seasons. And the reason for that is because we think it's easier to engage with local people and with young people before you've got a building than once your shiny emporium is open. So the season that we're launching our pre-opening period with is called Frequencies. You can find it online if you just search for Science Gallery London. And we are, as you'd imagine for that audience, across Twitter and Facebook and Instagram and indeed SoundCloud. And Frequencies is a good example because it's a season about the rhythms of life. So biology has many rhythms, from heartbeats, respiration cycles. We're also interested in weekly cycles of commuting and pollution, monthly cycles and annual cycles. And we've chosen 9 individuals ranging from the head of the cancer centre to a hospital porter, to a borough market trader, which is a food market nearby, and each of them have been paired up with composers. So they've generated very rapidly sounds that capture the rhythms of their lives, And these sounds are all available on SoundCloud through SciGallery Lon. You can listen to them. You can remix them if you want to, anyone in the world. They're available under a Creative Commons license. And by bringing together these sound engineers, these sound artists, these composers, with these practitioners, these scientists, these market traders, these porters, we're exploring the rhythms of life in a very unusual way, but I think a very accessible way, because young people listen into this kind of thing quite frequently.
Dan, I wanted to ask you a bit about the rhythm, I guess, of your own life, if it were, because you're a busy man. You were a judge on this for this year's Man Booker Prize here in the UK. And I wanted to ask you a bit about that, because it always intrigues me how the judges manage to integrate this astonishing volume of reading into their presumably ordinarily very hectic schedules. And for yourself, it must be particularly intense with all of this going on. How did the process treat you this time around?
Well, it was an extraordinary thing. People who don't know the process have asked me, so you're going to do it again next year, Dan? And I'm like, are you mad? It's been an extraordinary drain. The thing about Man Booker is that all the judges read all the submitted books. So I'm happy to tell you that over the last 6 months, I've read 156 novels, which comes out at about a novel a day. And that's very, very hard work. At the same time, there is this extraordinary thing that happens when you get into a book, and we're all familiar with that. The first few pages you turn, and then they start to turn themselves. And I will say I read them all physically, not electronically. I didn't use any kind of electronic reading device because I felt it was important to be able to hold them. We met as judges every 50 or so to discuss what we thought, and my own recall of the books, I was very surprised at once I had them in front of me.
And has that process fed into science gallery stuff? Has that sort of made you rethink how to communicate with people, what programs you might sort of program in the future? Has it sort of rubbed off in a good way, other than just, you know, the odd bag under the eye, presumably at judging time?
At both ends of the day reading. Well, interestingly, a couple of the books on the shortlist deal with scientific and medical topics. I am the first scientist to be a judge, but I didn't play any role in bringing them onto the list. There's a brilliant book by Joshua Ferris on the shortlist called To Rise Again at a Decent Hour, which has been described as the catch-22 of dentistry. And Guy's Hospital in London has a very strong dental research department. It's very likely we'll do a season called Teeth, following that in Science Gallery, so I think that will have been an influence. And a lovely book also shortlisted was by Karen Joy Fowler called We Are All Completely Beside Ourselves. And chaps, don't let's spoil it, because there is a spoiler online. Avoid that if you plan to read it, folks. But it is a book about the nature of humanity and about our relationship with animals. And I think the process of reading 156 novels this year only served to emphasize for me the extent to which science is part of culture. It's not a separate thing that has its own life. It's something that's part of all of our lives, and novelists recognise that as any other practitioner would.
Dan, what about on a sort of public level then? I'm intrigued to see what your view would be then of how government, for example, addresses science and uses science in policy making, this sort of thing. Do you think that, let's say here in the UK, for example, does the government do a good enough job? It's all well and good talking about engagement with science, but does it need to be more integrated into the actual way that people think about the dominating issues of the day?
I'm not going to comment on the current government beyond saying that it has, I think, a good recognition of the economic power of science. And again, if we look at Ebola, it's very clear, if you listen to Jeremy Farrar, who's director of Wellcome Trust, that if we'd spent more money on boosting the health systems of West Africa 5 or 10 years ago, we'd be needing to spend a lot less money now to put the thing back together. And I think that lesson has been heard. I think that particularly the rise of Tech City, which is a region of London around the Old Street roundabout, where a huge proportion of the inward investment in technology in Europe comes to that particular part of London. So I think that contemporary politicians understand the need for science to be part of public life, and the need for themselves or their advisors to be cognizant of scientific issues in making policy. Now, the interesting question is, do scientists think enough about policy? Right? You can have evidence into policy, but is policy playing enough of a role in determining scientific priorities? We need pure science, but we also need scientists who are citizens.
I think that's a good place to maybe finish it and tell people that that Daniel Glazer was talking to us. Dr. Daniel Glazer is the director of Science Gallery, and it sounds like that phrase is eminently, or that name of a building, that it's not yet a building, is eminently Googleable, Twitterable, etc., etc., etc. Right, Daniel?
That's absolutely correct. And I should say that there is one in Dublin, and we're considering galleries in Bangalore, in New York and Melbourne. So popping up in a city near you soon.
Dr. Glazer, we'll see you soon. Thank you very much indeed. And that is it for edition 277 of the Monocle Weekly.
What a show that was, Rob. We crested highs and lows, I feel, in that show. I never thought I'd be discussing in such intimate detail about different animals, you know, sexual behaviours, predatory and otherwise.
No. And Jules was a good guest, wasn't he?
Yeah, he knows all about it.
A schoolboyish whippersnapper of a scientist, of a zoologist, I'd have said, with an unschoolboyish interest in animals having sex.
Yeah.
But very good at explaining it. The book looks really good. We've had some snippets of it, haven't we? We've been reading bits out about it.
If you are interested.
It's a lively read.
Yeah, in sort of, you know, same-sex flamingo parents. It's a must read.
I'd said the Daily Mail would have had something to say about that.
They're probably sort of fulminating, which is another good reason to read it.
Definitely. And I liked our scientist at the end, Dan Glaser. And
he's a clever man, Rob.
He was telling us on his way out, wasn't he, about the fact that all the media offering for Science Gallery is all made by sort of 15 to 25-year-olds.
That's it. So not just, they're kind of putting their money where their mouth is, which I think is very commendable and very sensible. So they're appealing to that more youthful demographic. They're getting them involved in actually selling the project. So hats off to them, I say. And hats off to the wonderful Monocle Weekly production crew, Rob.
Yes. Let's thank Alice Block?
Thank them by name.
She was the producer. Claire Urban was the studio manager. Thank you both very much. Through the glass. And Tom, thank you very much also for being such a wonderful co-presenter.
Thank you,
today.
Rob. Thank you, Rob.
And who knows, maybe this time next week we'll be in the same time, same place. But for the time being, from me, Robert Bounds.
And from me, Tom Edwards.
Thanks for tuning in.